is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again. Welcome to the show. Coming up, wine exports still heading down as a China ban still biting. And coming up, farmers have begun planting sunflower seeds in the north, encouraged to plant the bright yellow flowers to create a splash of colour and bring along some more tourists.
A few farmers, and us included, decided we wanted to put some sunflowers in. And as Matt was saying, you know, they're commercial production. But we've decided to open this little corner of the paddock up and invite visitors in for about 10 days in January.
And we'll also look at some reaction to the kangaroo inquiry as well. That's all coming up. You can always send us a text here at the Country Hour, 0467 922 684. But first up to some wine news now. The value of Australian wine exports has dropped to its lowest point in 5 years as the industry feels the effects of those Chinese government tariffs. Overall, exports dropped by as much as a quarter to $2.27 billion. Wine Australia's General Manager of Corporate Affairs and Regulation is Rachel Triggs.
So it will take a little bit of time before we can see the full effect of China. I think we really need to see to the end of the calendar year to see the full effect, given that the deposit tariffs were applied to Australian wine imported to China at the end of November in 2020. But in the last export report, we've seen that to the year ending 30 September 2021, Australian wine exports decreased by 24% in value to $2.27 billion and by 17% in volume to 638 million litres. And the average value has also declined by 9% to $3.56 per litre.
The UK had picked up some of the slack that Australia had lost given the lack of the Chinese market. I think it's decreased 62% in the last quarter. So how are exports going, particularly into the UK?
So if you look at the figures over the last 18 months, there has been a significant increase in exports to the UK, which has led to the market solidifying its place as Australia's number one destination by volume. And it's now actually overtaken, not surprisingly, mainland China as the number one destination by value. So that's pleasing, and we do continue to see an upkick in the UK market.
Despite a bit of focus on the United States market, it's seen quite a significant drop as well, 11%. What's that put down to?
The average value increased by 2% to $3.18 per litre, so that is a positive thing. But Australian wine exports to the US experienced a real boost in the second half of 2020 due to the COVID-19-related surge in the off-premise trade sales. So that's the, you know, not in the restaurants, in the retail outlets, where most Australian wine in the US is sold. And when the on-premise trade sector was shut down, so this year with the on-trade reopening and the off-trade subsiding to a more normal level of activity, there was a counter swing and exports declined overall. But we also do think that the delays in shipping across the globe is having an effect, particularly in timing of stock being able to reach the US.
There were reports of a grey trade in wine between Hong Kong and China. There was a bit of an uptick in exports to Hong Kong. Are you seeing that play out in your numbers?
No, we're certainly not seeing that. I mean, we don't have any visibility over where a wine is shipped after, you know, beyond where it's destined for export when it leaves Australia. And it's quite normal practice for stock to be shipped to a certain market, particularly where there's a zero tariff in place, and then on ship to other markets. So I certainly wouldn't speculate that that's what's driving the numbers to Hong Kong. And if you look at the data pre-China-Australia free trade agreement, before the tariff in China was eliminated, there's certainly fairly similar figures. So it is very likely that there was a lot of stock that was actually going into China when it was tariff-free and then was being dispersed to other markets, and that could have included Hong Kong.
Rachel Triggs is Wine Australia's General Manager of Corporate Affairs and Regulation. She was speaking to Cassie Huff. Well, still with wine and the vineyards in the Hunter Valley, they're not too exposed to the Chinese market. According to one winemaker, they've faced some other challenges, though, as Stuart Horden from Brokenwood explained to David Claughton.
The Hunter Valley is not an enormous exporter of wine. It makes up, for our business, only about 15% of our sales, but I guess indirectly it's a big impact in terms of wine needing to find another home, so the market becoming more competitive.
Were you exporting to China yourself?
A small amount. that's certainly dried up in the last 12 months.
What are your main markets overseas?
Our main markets was China, the USA, Canada, Sweden, and the UK. We're seeing good growth for us both in the US and the UK, but it's a smaller base for us. We're certainly far more domestic focused than export.
And so what's happening with the domestic side? Because we've got all the lockdown things affecting cellar door sales, significant upticks in people buying alcohol, though. So I imagine it hasn't all been bad.
It's very business specific. So retail's has been quite healthy over the last 12, 18 months during lockdown as people have been at home. Online sales have been good, but obviously cellar door visitation has been non-existent, and on-trade through restaurants, bars, etc. have also taken an enormous hit.
How many people have you had to lay off for this period?
We've been quite fortunate here at Broken Wood. We've been able to redirect a lot of our staff to the vineyard and keep everyone on the books. Staffing's obviously quite a challenge in the current environment, so we've been very keen to hang on to as many as we can, which we've been able to do, but certainly looking forward to things opening up again in a fortnight.
And are your plans looking good for that period? Because a lot of people are being are cautious, a bit concerned about people coming out of Sydney and the Hunter. A lot of cases in the Hunter, some 400 COVID cases there.
Yeah, I think it's something we're going to have to watch. For those that are double vaxxed and keen to get up, we're really happy to see them up here when we can do it.
Will you be asking for proof as they come through the door?
Every business will have a different setup, so we'll be certainly trying to make sure everyone that visits will be double vaxxed.
Right.
And all of our staff will be double vaccinated.
Right. Has that been hard to do?
No, it hasn't been too bad, to be honest. It's been manageable.
What about that pivot that many businesses you were saying had to make to mailing lists and online? What have you done in that area?
Look, Brokenwood has a very strong mailing club, as do a lot of businesses here in the Hunter Valley. So we've been in contact with them quite a lot, doing things such as online tastings, virtual tasting packs being sent out. Our retail presence has certainly helped. So
you're not getting squeezed by others that you're finding, you know, having to push their content, their product into the domestic market, given the exports are problematic in China?
I think that's probably something that we will potentially start to see over the next 18 months. But at this point, I think everyone's been just trying to get through COVID, to be honest.
How's this vintage looking?
We had a couple of inches of rain last week. We're just going through flowering. The valley looks fantastic at the moment, but there's a way to go. We generally start picking middle of January, so we're after a bit of some blue sky now, and we'll see what comes over the next 2 months.
Stuart Horden from Brokenwood Winery in the Hunter Valley.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, prices are certainly on the up and up for grains. Droughts in North and South America and supply chain issues have seen the prices climb. Canola recently cracked more than $1,000 a tonne, and cotton and wheat are also up on previous years. Steve Dalton is a commodity broker at Narrabri, and he told Lara Webster that prices are very strong, but he's cautioning growers who may be thinking of forward selling certain commodities.
There's been a steady interest in forward selling, you know, for a number of months now on all commodities. We've cautioned, though, on some commodities that have had a very strong underlying support base and market dynamic, and those being specifically high-protein wheat, durum and canola. The reason why we've cautioned being too aggressive or even forward selling those commodities at all is because there's really been no incentive, because the market's been well supported the whole way along through the dynamics and what's going on and what's causing those prices to rise. Therefore, there's been no rush to jump in. The second important point is that if you do jump in and then we do get a wet harvest, like the Bureau has forecast, it does put growers in a position where commodities such as canola and durum, chickpeas is another one, there's not a lot of options. Oh, there's not a lot of grades that you can deliver on those commodities. So therefore, if you don't produce the top grade, or you are weather affected that puts you out of delivering against that contract, you could be forced into a very expensive washout. Bread wheat's a little bit easier because you can do a full multi-grade contract where you can deliver at the high-end APH wheat all the way down to Fed 1. And those multi-grade contracts for bread wheat tend to be more flexible, whereas other commodities don't have that same flexibility. And the last thing people want to be doing is locking in what they think is a good price, only have to buy that contract back because the market's rallied against them and we've had a wet harvest.
For those who have decided not to lock in contracts, do you see prices dropping off anytime soon, or are you thinking they should remain steady at the very least?
Traditionally in northern New South Wales, we get harvesting most of our grains earlier than the central west or southern parts of New South Wales, Victoria, etc. So, you know, you would like to think that the odds are in our favour, that we'll get harvesting in our part of the world earlier than others. Therefore, the ability for us to weather any harvest pressure increases. So we should see less volatility in price during our harvest. But that is a risk, of course, harvest pressure and pressuring prices to the downside. But at the end of the day, I still think growers will get an opportunity to price at good prices, even if they wait until they know what they've got before they sell.
We've got issues we've been hearing quite a lot about in terms of shipping grain, containers. Tell me how you're seeing all of those issues and the media and talk around them play into things at the moment.
Look, COVID certainly has disrupted the supply chain, not just for agriculture, but for all, the whole supply chain around the world, for all economies, it seems. But specifically locally, what we're seeing the effects here is lack of what we call equipment or containers. So buyers are finding it very difficult to source containers to export, especially pulses, chickpeas and faba beans in northern New South Wales. We'll see most of our wheat go out on bulk vessels, and you know that supply chain's really going to be at its capacity, and we're probably seeing less issues there in the bulk supply chain market as we are in the container market. But essentially, we're just not able to get the containers because the shipping lines are making more money on other routes and transporting different goods other than agricultural goods. So, yes, lack of containers are a big issue for pulses, and I don't see that improving anytime soon, which is just going to mean that there's going to be a real backlog. The container packers up country just won't have the containers or the capacity to move the grain as quickly as they normally would, which will just hold up growers being able to deliver.
Narrabri-based commodity broker Steve Dalton speaking to Lara Webster. Well, across the Liverpool Plains of northern New South Wales, farmers have begun planting sunflower seeds, and not just because it's part of their summer cropping rotations. Local committees are actually encouraging farmers and residents in towns across the region to plant the bright yellow flowers to create a trail in the new year that tourists can follow. At Windy Station near Quirindi, hundreds of hectares have been sown, as Lara Webster reports.
Along the driveway to Windy Station, it's very wet and muddy thanks to some recent rain. Rain which has been very well timed for 200 hectares of sunflower seeds just planted. Seeds which will become a spectacle for tourists come January. Windy Station Woolshed Manager Claire Lee and Operations Manager Matt Kelly both joined me by the sunflower patch.
G'day Lara, welcome to, well, back to Windy. We're here in what we call Block 2. It's we've got about 200 hectares of sunflowers in here, and as you can see, they've just started coming up, so it's all pretty exciting. That's half the battle, is getting them in and getting them up at this time of year when it's this wet. So,
what has this rain done at the moment? Is it good timing?
Yeah, it is for these. Obviously, it's a nice balancing act with the summer crop program. It's trying to get rain on the stuff we've planted and then trying to be dry enough to keep the rest of it rolling, sort of thing. So, it's good for these guys, and yeah, hopefully it keeps coming eventually.
This is all part of the sunflower trail we've got going on across the Liverpool Plains. You're just one of a number of farmers taking part. Tell me what it is about sunflowers that made Windy Station want to take part in this trail.
Well, I guess from my perspective, agronomically, they're quite a good fit for us. We sort of are trying to get this part of the farm into a tighter rotation. So for them to this to go back into wheat, it actually fits quite well. We would like to have planted the whole block to sunflowers, but I don't think that we would have flooded the market, I think, at that rate. So yeah, for us it's a good fit, and then for Claire also to fit this into the agritourism that we're trying to develop here is great.
Absolutely. So it's always a spectacle across the plains for the tourists, but you mentioned there markets wise there is a little bit of an issue there when it comes to markets and where you send the seeds at the end of it.
That's right. So yeah, we've planted 200 hectares here, so at the what we hope yield-wise would be quite a significant amount of sunflower seeds. So mostly for bird seed with these Barenbrug varieties. So yeah, not so much going into oil and those markets. It's really only bird seed. But if there was a potential to develop an oil market, it'd be great, because we'd like to see more of them, given they're such a small window crop and they fit quite well into this system.
Now, you are, as well as planting these, you have started, you've got your winter crop to come off, and as you say, there's a bit of a balancing act there at the moment, but you've also, along with the sunflowers here, had a bit of cotton go in. How is the summer planting program going at the moment?
From our perspective, it's great. From our contractor's perspective, he's probably having a bit more fun. Late nights pulling things out of bogs.
Some bogs sort of here and there.
Yeah. But from our perspective, we've started reasonably well. It's obviously a bit of a challenge getting soil temperatures up, but we'll get there eventually. And still got a bit of time to get the cotton in. There's still probably two-thirds of the program to go, I'd say, and then we'll move back into sorghum. So we've got a bit of early sorghum in as well before that.
Claire, I will bring you into the conversation now. And Matt had mentioned that the sunflowers are a big part of agritourism here at Windy Station, which you are very much promoting. And I guess I want to start with just what role you see the sunflowers playing here for Windy Station as it continues its growth in agritourism.
Yeah, so I suppose we started in the agritourism diversification with the woolshed. That's still undergoing some planning and documentation with Heritage New South Wales. So this is a great way for us to just move into that space a little softly. And last year, well, the beginning of this year, we saw Ian Carter with his beautiful crops of sunflowers. So a few farmers, and us included, decided we wanted to put some sunflowers in. And as Matt was saying, you know, they're commercial production. But we've decided to open this little corner of the paddock up and invite visitors in for about 10 days in January.
And that's to coincide with the Country Music Festival, of course. So what will it be like, do you think, to be able to welcome visitors onto farm, especially as we see COVID restrictions easing too?
Yeah, it's really exciting. And it's so exciting to be able to have something for people to come and visit in our region. So we're really looking forward to it. We'll probably be flowering a little earlier than Country Music, but it's really going to feed into people coming for Country Music. I hope we get some visitors from Sydney so that they can just come and breathe the space, because during COVID, we really have been lucky to be out here. So lucky.
Claire Lee from Windy Station near Quirindi speaking there to Lara Webster. It's coming up to 23 minutes past 12. We've got some texts on the wine issue and the Chinese tariffs. Greg at The Rules texted in saying, how much does the government's anti-Chinese rhetoric hurt Australia's trade with our biggest trader? Wouldn't a diplomatic approach work better than a Cold War style of communication? How will this approach affect many other industries, including where things are made in China that we need, including electric vehicles or solar panels? That one from Greg. And there's a few other texts about the kangaroo issue. We'll get to them shortly because we're talking about kangaroos now at 24 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour. Because the Shooters, Farmers and Fishers Party think that the New South Wales Government kangaroo inquiry and subsequent findings didn't really grasp the main issues relating to kangaroo numbers, control and their impact on agriculture. Member for Barwon, Roy Butler, says the composition of the committee that looked into the issues was left of centre and not really cognizant of the true picture of kangaroos out west. But he did make the point that the evidence presented about illegal shooting, illegal trespass and animal welfare breaches, he said those issues are very disturbing and not to be tolerated.
Look, Michael, no law-abiding firearms owner would support or condone behaviour like that. You know, that just gives good law-abiding firearms owners a bad name. Anyone who is engaging in illegal activity or, you know, cruel activity with firearms probably doesn't deserve to have firearms. It just it's too much of a tightly regulated space. You know, there's significant checks that go on before people are given a firearms license. It's just absolutely unacceptable that anyone would do anything illegal with a firearm, and certainly the police need to get involved if that's happening. They need to investigate, and if there's merit or if there's substance to the allegations that people have done the wrong things with firearms, they need to investigate.
And what was your response when you heard that the evidence about kangaroos not being being left to die, being shot and wounded, and animal welfare breaches?
Look, any shooter who hunts animals would find that totally unacceptable. What you're always trying to do when you're taking an animal, whether it's for food or whether it's pest destruction, is you're looking to kill that animal outright as quickly as possible. So, you know, that should be one shot to the head, or in some larger animals, it would be a heart-lung area. And you want that animal to pass as quickly as possible without any kind of, you know, distress or trauma. You certainly don't want them to be conscious, you know, whilst they're suffering from a wound. So, again, you just, like anyone who is involved in shooting and is passionate about shooting wouldn't find it acceptable that anyone leaves an animal injured doesn't go and make sure that it's dead, and if it's got young around it or if it's got a joey in the pouch or anything like that, make sure that it's taken care of as well, because, you know, that's like cruelty to animals. I think most people, and I mean, I deal with a lot of people out west, you know, farmers and people who use firearms as part of what they do. I think people who are okay with seeing cruelty or harm come to animals, they're not right in the head.
The other issue is they also talked about exclusion fencing being a concern, allowing the kangaroos to move freely across the plains. Have you got any thoughts on that? Because it is something that is expanding out west.
Yeah, it is. And look, as the margins, I mean, keep in mind that agriculture in Australia has one of the lowest levels of subsidy in the world. So people need to invest in their infrastructure to make sure that they can protect crops, that they can protect essentially what's going to keep their bills paid for the next 12 months, especially if they've got the chance to have a good season like they do now. And as I said, Michael, the other thing I'm going to keep driving home is there are vast tracts of land where there is no fencing, where there is no one who's meant to be in there shooting native animals, vast tracts of land where these animals can go about their life uninterrupted. In the areas of agricultural production, there will be fencing, and fencing is important in terms of trying to keep, you know, some of those animals off crops and out of paddocks, you know, especially with the margins being as tight as they are.
So the conversation being had about exclusion fencing, you think that it's, we're not talking about a large area of land here, and there would be enough area for the kangaroos to move freely across the plains. You think it's a bit of a beat up?
I think there's plenty of areas for kangaroos to move freely about. And I look at the composition of the committee, and, you know, the committee wasn't made up of people who live out west, wasn't made up of people who are involved in agriculture. Generally, the composition's fairly left of centre. So I'm not surprised by some of the recommendations. I guess I'm disappointed that, you know, the voice of people like the Pastoral Association of West Darling didn't get more of a run. You know, I've spoken to people about kangaroos, kangaroo populations for a long time, and I've been travelling around the West for over 20 years in different roles. And some of the findings that in regards to commercial harvest and non-commercial harvest, you know, it's a negligible impact on the overall kangaroo populations. But the way it's been worded in the report is that commercial harvest and non-commercial harvest has a significant impact. I can tell you now that weather, rain, has by far the biggest impact on kangaroo populations. When it's a good season, they breed up. When we're in drought, as we had, you know, for 3 years or so between 2017 and 2020, that's the worst of the drought. That was when populations really did drop off. But it's a natural cycle. I mean, when populations drop like that, right now I can tell you they're breeding up. You go to some places out west at the moment, and if you walk quietly up onto a valley or on top of a hill, you'll see the whole hillside move like a carpet, like they're bred back up very quickly.
What do you make of this contradiction that we're hearing between the call for overseas labour to come in from November the 1st when the flights start coming in, Agriculture Minister here in New South Wales, and also the Premier of New South Wales saying they want to see that happen because we need help on farms for the harvest, and yet the Prime Minister from the same party, also the Trade Minister, saying, you know, that can't happen until all the Australians have come in. What do you make of that sort of contradiction?
Well, given they're the same political cloth, it's surprising they didn't compare notes before they started speaking to the media. Certainly the issue is real, the issue of agricultural workers, both for you know, orchardists and for cropping at the moment. Just that labour workforce is going to be incredibly important in coming months. And if we've got the opportunity to bring people in, we certainly need to look at a way to do that. It's a shame that, yeah, they hadn't had a discussion between themselves about what that looked like before they started taking it public.
There's Roy Butler, who's the member for Barwon. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 12:30. I've got a couple of texts on that issue in regards to the kangaroo issue. Skippy Troy has texted in saying, grey kangaroos are in plague proportions. He says, harvesting wild-caught, healthy, nutritious meat, and the hides are environmentally friendly. They're sustainable. They create rural and regional jobs, and they also create export dollars for Australia. Not many export dollars out of the kangaroo meat at the moment. A bit of a hiatus in that at the moment, but those thoughts from Skippy Troy. It's coming up to 29 minutes to one, and it's time to get some news headlines now from Adam Storey, who's decided to join us today.
Oh, he says with a grin the size of Sydney heads. Yes, well, as I said, when the doctor says careful, these may make you drowsy.
Oh, well, I thought it was a big weekend because of the lockdown.
No, it wasn't actually. I saw a couple of family members on Saturday, and that was it. And
well, you're here. That's the main thing.
I'm here
thing.
Now.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
We'll be
that's
here
right.
again tomorrow. Maybe.
Okay, very yeah. good. All right. Very good.
The chief health officer is warning while COVID figures are tracking down in New South Wales, she does anticipate they will rise again. For the second day in a row, the numbers are below 300, with 273 cases reported today. The Nationals backbencher Matt Canavan is vowing to keep fighting against the government's new climate change plan. He says no level of detailed modelling will change his mind, and he's also accused the government of not providing enough information. State Liberal MPs will be given a conscience vote on a voluntary assisted dying bill. That was confirmed this morning after a party room meeting where it was unanimously decided that MPs would be allowed a conscience vote. The Chamber of Commerce and Industry has labelled the skill shortage in Australia as the worst in 20 years. It says the shortage of skilled labour is being felt across every sector of the economy, but is hitting particularly hard in health, education, engineering and trades. And of course, I'm sure you're across the news that Emma Watkins, the yellow wiggle, has quit the group and is leaving. Now, unfortunately,
why would I necessarily
Well, the spot's already
been
taken. I know you were aiming for the yellow jersey.
Dancing is not my forte.
She's going to be replaced by Sahai Hawkins, who's already sort of done some cameos with the group. But I was just looking on. She's only in year 10.
Yeah, I know. She's 15.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Yeah. Adopted by an Australian family and came from Ethiopia.
Oh, okay. There you go. So you are you across the system.
Occasionally I glance at the ABC website.
Yeah. Well, yes. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know then, so I'll just be on my way.
But is it Anthony Fields the only original one?
Yeah.
I didn't realise he was still there.
Yeah.
Oh, just can't stay away.
So it'll be like ACDC, so no original members at all.
It's a couple, isn't there? Is it one?
What? A couple?
A couple. I think there's two. Two left.
Oh, two originals.
Yeah, the ACDC.
I don't know about these things, Michael. Know a bit more about it than me. Anyway, spot's taken. You're missed out again.
Yeah, there you go. Not to worry. Yeah. Not to worry. Right. Well, I have to find something else to do.
Yeah. Well, there's a skill shortage. You could, you know.
Yeah. Pick up a trade.
Pick up a trade, mate.
All right.
Get a real job.
Yeah, all right. That's the thought for the day. Thanks for that, Adam. Right. Adam's story there with news headlines and also career advice. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's time to get some weather details from David Wilkie at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. How are you going?
Very well. So what's happening in the weather today? Is it still a bit of moisture on the coast?
Yeah, that's the story. So generally, we've got a couple of things happening. We've got the trough that's sort of forming offshore, and we've got another one that's moving up the south coast. So quite a bit of cloud on the southern coast and a few thunderstorms as that kind of change moves up the coast. And what we're expecting is easterlies to pretty much dominate over the coastal region over the next few days. So showers in the east, but generally pretty dry and warming through the inland. But yeah, so far I haven't seen a whole lot in terms of rain in general since 9 a.m. It's mostly been pretty patchy, and the total was 2:09 a.m. yesterday. Well, this morning they were mostly with thunderstorms about the northeast. So there are a few isolated reasonable totals up there, getting up to sort of 40-60 millimeters in the northern rivers. But But yeah, otherwise this rainfall in the south has been mostly pretty light. We are expecting it to be fairly persistent over the next few days. I think we'll get some reasonable accumulations over the next couple of days. But yeah, it might just be a sort of steady building thing that we have to sort of keep an eye on.
And what sort of areas of the state are likely to get the most, and sort of is it going to come up through the Riverina Central West and then up to the New England Northwest, or what's the sort of trajectory of it?
Yeah, I mean, the pattern is quite coastal, so
right.
Dividing range acting as a pretty good barrier, so most of the rainfall, like fairly moderate totals on and east of the ranges, but four places west of the Great Divide, pretty patchy. And the next sort of best time for them to get some rain, so through the inland parts, is probably on Saturday, so that's when the next front comes through. But it's not looking like a really wet front. Like it's looking like a front that's going to have thunderstorms with it, so I think some areas will get some good rain with it, but there'll probably be most areas missing out. So yeah, that's on Saturday, and I think probably the areas that are more likely are about sort of New England northwest, potentially, but as I said, it's with thunderstorms, so it's not looking really favourable. And probably in the south, the Riverina looking fairly dry. So, yeah, mostly going to miss out, I think, with this event.
Oh, there's some areas there that they wouldn't mind it to be a dry for a bit, and also the central west where they've got a bit of they've had a bit too much rain, so that there might be some people that are quite keen to see that. Some this change coming through on Saturday, but it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot in it at this stage.
No, not at this stage. No, I think generally what we're going to see is the change move through, and so I mean there's going to be this easterlies for the next few days, so some showers through eastern parts, potentially some storms in places, and even some severe storms in the northeast. But that's going to sort of ease off as we head into the latter part of the week, and then when the front comes through, it kind of re-energizes it. So, as it comes through, it might bring some rainfall through the western slopes, but with thunderstorms, so pretty sporadic. But probably the more noticeable thing that it will do is bring a bit of heat. So we're going to see heat building through the inland. I think Burke's already got to about 31 today. But we'll be seeing a number of places through the inland getting to a 30, 35-ish. And then that sort of heat pushing coastward as the front comes across. So, yeah, I think that's probably going to be the main thing that people through the inland will notice. It's getting warmer, certainly feeling a bit more like summer.
Getting warmer for the next few days.
Yes, yeah, until the front. So the front will come through on Sunday and that'll clear things up a little bit. But, yeah, ahead of it, pretty warm. And for parts of the east, because we've got the humidity building with these easterlies, once the heat kind of moves to the coast, I think it'll be reasonably muggy. So, yeah, a bit of a taste of that kind of late summer humidity for parts of the northeast as we move into Saturday.
Okay, David, thanks for that.
No problem, thanks.
It's 22 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Got a few texts on the kangaroos. Juliet Warren says nothing's changed in the cruel kangaroo killing issue. She says she remembers a teacher telling her about a young pupil giving the news that he went out shooting with his father, a so-called professional, and got a stick and then beat the joeys to death with that stick. Julie said it was pretty horrific at the time. Tim's texted in to say they're more than happy with the professionalism of their ex-hairdresser, who's now a professional lady kangaroo harvester and shooter. She is a real asset to their community, says Tim. And a few other texts coming through on the kangaroo issue as well. So we might get to them a little bit later on in the program. But right now, let's turn our attention to macadamias, because the harvest is all but over here in Australia. And the industry is hoping to deliver close to 54,000 tonnes for 2021. And while the amount of exports has lifted this year, Australia's share of the global supply is slipping despite some new plantings, as Kim Honan reports.
After it revised down its start of season forecast, the Australian Macadamia Society now expects the crop will bounce back, and the country's largest and fastest growing area, Bundaberg, is behind that lift. Chief Executive Officer Jolyon Burnett.
Some areas in the Northern Rivers were a little bit down on the previous year. Southeast Queensland was pretty steady, a little bit up on last year, but Bundaberg is where the growth is at the moment. Those new plantings are now getting into their sort of 5 to 10 year age and really beginning to contribute, and I think that helped lift the total crop from what otherwise might have been a bit of an ordinary one.
The percentage of Australia's crop exported this year has increased slightly from 75 to 80%. Julian Burnett says that's a reflection of the continuing strong demand for macadamias globally.
With COVID, food service and some of the sort of more walk-through markets have taken a hit. Tourism, restaurants, those sorts of things. But demand generally does remain strong.
And with that strong global demand, where does that place Australia in the market, given there are other major players in the industry, South Africa planting more, of course, China as well?
Yeah, look, Australia's share of the total global supply is slipping. Other countries, particularly the African continent, as you say, China, Vietnam and South America, they're all planting. Their combined sort of growth is faster than ours. So we are slipping as a percentage of total supply. But I think we remain the macadamia of first preference purchase in most markets.
It's been a record year for the world's largest macadamia company, Marquis Group, which operates in South Africa and here in Australia, where it has in excess of 360 growers in New South Wales and Queensland. Marquis Marketing General Manager Charles Cormack says nut and shell receivables and kernel sales are up 20%.
It's been a surprising year for us. You know, when the COVID pandemic first hit us last year, gave us a bit of a sucker punch and the industry was not really prepared for it. This year we were kind of prepared and I guess hoping for the best but preparing for the worst. And it's really, the business has really come back strongly, and so we're very happy with our results this year.
And while the demand for whole kernels remained strong throughout the pandemic, there's been a pickup in demand for the smaller styles this year,
which is really indication of the food service industry coming alive again. Obviously, during the pandemic, many cafes, restaurants and so on had closed down food service. So that's coming alive and that's driving the consumption of cookies and, you know, other bakery goods and so on.
Marquis exports to some 45 countries around the world. And while markets like China and the US remain strong, Mr. Cormack says that its growth is in Korea, where sales have doubled in the last year.
Korea, I guess, is a market that is rapidly maturing. The food manufacturers and the retailers are starting to put macadamias into a wider variety of products, and I think that's driving the demand. So we're seeing demand for a broader cross-section of kernel styles going into that market, which is indicating that there's, you know, diversity in the demand going on.
Julian Burnett says while the industry is looking at building up those newer markets like Korea and Taiwan, it's also actively exploring new markets such as India, which has the potential to become a 10,000 to 20,000 ton market for Australia.
The Australian government is now quite active in its free trade negotiations with India. We're hoping that might deliver a positive result, in which case certainly the Indian market is a market that has huge potential for us.
What benefits would there be for Australian growers exporting to India?
What it means is it just provides another market for global supply. The worst thing for us would be for supply to overtake demand. That obviously puts downward pressure on price. So we're keen to see strong demand growth, and the Indian market certainly has the potential to do that. Now, what role Australian macadamias play in supplying that Indian market, we'll see. But if we follow the trend of history, we're very good at getting into markets quickly, developing markets, claiming a bit of market share. And then as that market matures and grows, we've always tried to position ourselves at the higher value end of those markets.
And with the strong demand for macadamias globally, what impact has that had on price? Charles Cormack.
So at the beginning of the season, prices did come back a little bit. And that was, you know, obviously driven by the uncertainty in the market and so on. But yes, we have seen a slight firming in prices, both in nut and shell and in kernel, and that's been driven by both, you know, that increase in demand on the demand side, but also in both South Africa and Australia, the crop has been slightly revised down. So, you know, that gave a signal to the market that there might not be as much product available as they initially anticipated early in the season.
Despite this, Mr. Cormack says that suppliers are unlikely to receive an end-of-year bonus and that it's too early to say if farm gate prices will lift next year.
Kim Honan with that report.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the rural property market around Condobolin is booming thanks to consecutive wet years in the district. Local agent Paddy Ward says prices have risen by as much as 50% on some properties in the last 12 months, with listings turning over rapidly amid some increased interest in the region. The rural property sales agent at Ray White says the town also is booming as well.
The demand for rural properties at the moment is very great. It's I think that's just off the back of a good harvest last year and very favourable seasonal conditions at the moment. We're looking down the barrel of another really, really good harvest. There's water in the river. The water allocations are all over 100%. The irrigation's looking good. The cotton's just going in now. So it's all looking really positive.
And is there a fair bit of stock turning over?
Yeah, there is. So you know, people keep saying, oh, you know, you haven't got many listings, but they're just selling very quickly, so we don't have the listing on the market for very long. A lot of places may sell before advertising. And, look, I think at the moment it's a buyer's and a seller's market. A seller, you know, can get out and get a pretty fair, pretty good price at the moment, and a buyer can come in and you can get finance for cheap, the interest rate's low, and you can take advantage of high commodity prices and a good season.
So have prices risen a lot here recently? What has the sort of average price gone in the district?
Yeah, they have. So in 2016, we had a pretty good year and prices went up fairly well, and then sort of 17, 18, 19, there was not a lull, but it just didn't rise as rapidly as we saw in 2016. Then we've hit 2020, 2021, and prices, yeah, have increased dramatically. It's really good to see. We're seeing sort of anywhere between, 10 to 50% price increases in the last 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, wow. And who's buying these properties? Is it locals expanding, or is it people coming from outside of town?
Yeah, look, it is locals expanding. They'll take advantage, and if their neighbours come up or a property in the district comes up, they'll snap it up or try to. It's a very tightly held area, Condobolin, and there's a lot of large families that have been here for a long time. But then we've also seen some bigger properties in the area that have been purchased by people from outside the district, and they're looking at coming up to another place to start a family, and they sort of see the value in the country up here at Condobolin.
Yeah, right. So they've come from other areas. Is that because what they've been priced out over that where they're from, or are they just sort of like the area?
I think it's a number of reasons. The prices might be getting up in their area, but then they just see that Condobolin is still an area you can make money from. You know, you can make good money from agriculture. You can see the profit margins straight away, whereas other areas, you know, they might be getting a bit closer to major cities and might be getting a bit of that lifestyle pricing in it as well.
It's not just rural properties. The demand for sort of accommodation and rentals in town is also quite strong.
Yeah, look, we've got nearly 100 rentals on our books, and I think it's, the town's full, and there's a couple of mines starting up here, and a lot of demand for workers' rentals and things like that. So, look, it's great to see.
Paddy Ward is a rural property sales agent at Ray White in Condobolin. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 11 minutes to 1.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, Tilba Dairy has used the lockdown period to expand their retail and manufacturing facilities despite taking a hit to their bottom line. Erica Dibden from the Tilba Dairy and Cheese Factory says that while COVID-19 has been hard on the business, the current seasonal conditions are some of the best she's ever seen.
Look, we've had a wonderful season. We've probably had the best season that we've had for quite some time. So in terms of growing grass and cow health and happiness and milk production, we have never reached what we've achieved. So we're pretty happy with that. We are putting as much feed away as we can, because we all know that in farming, whilst a good season is fantastic, it's not too far away before a tight season comes. So we're putting as much silage down as we can. We've decided to not do maize or corn this year. We're going to go with grass silage and really concentrate on that. And so our lovely Jerseys are milking really well at the moment, and hopefully we can store some more feed through this wonderful sunshine and rain that we've had. So for the next dry season that arrives, we'll be fairly prepared for it.
What's the pandemic been like for your business?
Look, it's been really, really challenging. We have retail here at Tilba in the Tilba Township, and we also wholesale to our local area and through to Canberra and up to Sydney. And whilst our Canberra and Sydney runs have remained fairly steady, there is a decline locally just by the sheer virtue of less people coming to the coast because people haven't really been allowed or able to travel. So that certainly affects, I'm sure, not only our business, but a lot of food producers that are selling into the region. That certainly affects sales on the bottom line. So that whilst you can manage and navigate your way through that short term, I think that the economic rationale behind that is going to be probably years of rebuilding to get over what has just happened to us. It's been fairly major.
Have you looked at the numbers, and can you put a figure on how significant the downturn has been or a percentage impact on your business?
Yes, I can. I can tell you exactly. We're sitting at around a 34% decline for the first quarter of 21-22, which mightn't sound that significant, but it represents a lot of cash flow that whilst we, like I said before, we may be able to navigate through now. However, I think that there will be some tough times to try and overcome a cash deficit in the next 6 to 12 months.
Erica Dibden has spent part of the lockdown period expanding their business, moving the retail operation next door and purchasing new cheese packaging equipment from Germany. And while this has been challenging in the short term, she's optimistic about the months ahead.
I think the coast in general is going to experience an amazing upturn, and it's now for our business, what we're thinking is that we're going to be seeing people visiting the area unlike we have seen before, and purely people wanting to get out of the city and wanting to come and have a little bit of coastal lifestyle. So I think it's going to be phenomenal, and whilst it will really help from a cash flow point of view to build up what you've lost, usually we're preparing for this time 6 months in advance. So we've had like skeleton staff and we've been affected like everyone else. And so now we're trying to madly scramble to build our stock levels back up to have the onslaught, which hopefully will arrive very, very soon onto the coast. It has been busier already, but I think it will be a wonderful season for all.
Erica Dibden from Tilba Dairy and the Tilba Cheese Factory, and she was speaking there to Josh Becker. Let's go to Forbes Sheep and Lambs and Crystal Ridley.
Good afternoon. Numbers fell this sale with agents yarding 21,450 head. Those 18,000 lambs panned and quality was similar to that of the previous sales. Not all the usual buyers are present competing in a fairly steady market. There were 7,200 new season lambs panned and prices remained fairly similar. Trade weights of 26 kilos sold from 192 to 253, with heavy lambs selling from 245 to 275. Carcass prices averaged from 8.98 to 9.37 cents. Restockers were again strong, paying from 178 to 212. Old lambs lifted $6 a head, with trade weights to 26 kilos selling from 196 to 244. Export lambs receiving from 243 to 309. Merino lambs ranged in price from 196 to $240 a head. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
Let's go to Carcore Cattle now, David Monk.
Numbers fell by 400 for a yarding of 924. It was a good quality yarding with a fair selection of young cattle to suit the feeders and trade buyers, along with some outstanding grass steers and heifers in prime condition. There were 170 cows yarded, which were mostly prime heavyweights. Young cattle of the trade were firm to 4 cents dearer, with prime vealers selling to 589. Prime yearlings sold from 465 to 559. Feeder steers and heifers were 5 cents dearer, with the feeder steers selling from 470 to 585, while the feeder heifers sold from 470 to 572. Young cattle of the restockers remained strong, with the young steers selling to 766 and the young heifers 668. Ground steers were up to 10 cents dearer, while the ground heifers were 5 cents dearer. Prime ground steers sold from 420 to 520, while the ground heifers sold from 415 to 490. Cows were 5 cents cheaper, with the 2 and 3 scores selling from 283 to 385. Prime heavyweight cows sold from 390 to 413 to average 404. Heavy bulls sold to 347. This is David Monk at CTLX for MLA.
Let's go to Gunnedah for the report there with James Armitage.
Good afternoon. Numbers increased to 2,330 head. Large supplies of yearlings, not many cows. Quality and conditions mostly good. A fair supply of HGP treated yearlings all going on to feed. All the regular buyers operated, along with the return of a processor, albeit in a limited capacity. A very strong market that saw lightweight yearling steers to restockers substantially dearer, up to 280 kilos, selling from 680 to 818 cents a kilo. The next weight range to 330 kilos, 580 to 718. Medium and heavyweight feeder steers sold to dearer trends. Discounts for the HGP treated lots. Medium weights 478 to 642. Heavyweights 440 to 592 cents. Lightweight heifers reached 724 cents. Medium weight feeders 440 to 566 cents. Strong gains taking breeds into account. Heavy steers to process were dearer, selling from 420 to 569. Cows were slightly cheaper, 375 to 395 cents a kilo for heavy 3 and 4 scores. James Armitage for MLA in Canada.
Let's go to Inverell Cattle now and Stephen Adams.
Good afternoon. Inverell numbers increased by 329 to 1,035, mostly good quality cattle, with a smaller offering of plainer quality types. There was a large offering of Boss Indicus cross heifers and a well-presented yarding of cows. A full panel of buyers were present, with the return of an exporter after a long absence. Restockers led the competition through the weaner offering, 648 to 776 for steers, heifers to 594, light steers to 616. A reduction in quality for pens of medium yearling feeders saw a cheaper trend, 420 to 615, the heavy feeders to a dearer trend, 399 to 521. Medium feeder heifers sold to a dearer trend, 416 to 574, and quality reduction through some of the heavy drafts were cheaper, 408 to 459. Ground steers to process 10 cents better to 442. Similarly, the heifer offering dearer, 394 to 428. Heavy cows firm, light cows slightly cheaper, 313 to 334. Heavy bulls, 300 to 344. Stephen Adams, MLA at Inverell.
And let's go to Scone Cattle now and Neil Geddes.
Afternoon. Numbers jumped to 735 cattle, majority younger, with less percentages of the vealers compared to the yearlings. Restocker demand was very strong for the lighter end. Over 200 kilogram vealer steers returned to the paddock, dearer trend, 680 to 800 cents. Same weight heifer portion also to the restockers, 570 to 704 cents. Lightweight yearling steers to the restockers, dearer trends, 576 to 748 cents. Heavier end to feed and the restockers, 460 to 622 cents a kilogram. Yearling heifers a little cheaper, breed and quality related, to the restockers, 470 to 650 cents. Prime condition younger cattle, strong competition from the butchers and processors, the best up around the 556 cents a kilogram. Ground steers and bullocks a little cheaper, 380 to 440 cents. The best older heifer reached 506 cents a kilogram. Cows firm, the better covered heavyweight, 355 to 380. The best heavyweight bull reached 330 cents a kilogram. Neil Geddes, Scone Cattle for the MLA.
And that's the market information for today. No Wodonga cattle. We weren't able to bring that to you for some reason today.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And just looking at some of the texts coming through, Troy's texted saying he's proposing, talking about kangaroos, he's proposing an exclusion fence to keep the woke populist fruitcakes out of the bush and keep them in La La Land instead. And Al's saying, what can be done for the kangaroo? He's suggesting a charge on all the users, all those people that use the names or the images of kangaroos, including governments or tourism or Vegemite or Cadbury, or citizens using the name in business. Maybe they should charge a bit for the use of the name or the image, and then that can be used, that money can be used to help out the kangaroo population. You're listening to The Country Hour. We're heading up to news time. It's nearly 1 o'clock.